First of all, I would like to thank very much the organizers of this special year and special thematic year of inviting me to come to this wonderful institution and to meet once again friends. And I want to apologize in advance. Some of you have heard parts of this talk, so feel free to leave. And there is one more methodological statement that I have to make. Various parts of this work that I'm going to explain to you are joint work with Gabor Dickbills, who is not here, and Peter Reiner. Some was done, and David Holtman. Some was done by Adrian Nachman, who is also sitting here a long time ago. So whenever I say I or we, this means a non-empty subset of the names which was mentioned before, which might not include even me, but still this is an idea. So let me perhaps explain very briefly first some motivation for this. Of course, there is Francois Treves wrote a few years ago a survey article in the notices of the AMS where he says that this subject is a trove where you can find lots and lots of richness, and this is in the intersection of a long list of subjects in mathematics, PDE, representation theory, even control theory. But we are going to look at it primarily from the analysis point of view. Now, generally speaking, there are two main methods used in the past to study partial differential equations, linear partial differential equations. One is the Fourier method, this operator for constant coefficients, and here you see the method. Since the Fourier transform makes differentiations into multiplications, you have at least formally this formula. Do you have a stick or something like this here? Okay, so I will use my fingers. Well, okay, this is usually the secret in all institutions because these are usually stolen, so they hide them. Okay, I will use a pen. So here you have a formula for the inverse, at least a formal formula for the inverse of an operator. This leads to pseudo-differential operators. Pseudo-differential operators, however, are good for operators which, if not of constant coefficients, are almost, in a sense which I don't want to make precise, but in a sense which can make precise, are almost of constant strength, are perturbations somehow of operators of constant coefficients. If you think all classes, all the way up to Hermanders, rho delta classes, and so on, these are all essentially operators of constant coefficients with which you did something. Then there is an entirely different method, which is due to Jacques Adamar, I think, which is good only for second-order operators. And there, suppose you have an operator L, summation Aij, and you associate it, if the matrix Aij is non-singular, you associate it with this metric. Now, this metric is not necessarily positive definite. If, in the elliptic case, it is positive definite, in the non-elliptic case, it maybe has Lorentzian signature, then you have a wave operator. And then you can associate with these matrices two iconal equations, one for the length, summation Aij d equal 1. This one has a disadvantage that the solution is singular at a point. Or, if you take the length square, the energy, you have an equation which has everywhere smooth solutions. So this is, in the Riemannian case, it will give you the Riemannian distance. In the standard case, for the usual Laplacian, you get the usual Euclidean distance. And with this distance, you can, in the standard cases, you can write various operators. That is the green kernel, the heat kernel, and then this is not Adamar. What Adamar did is that he looked at operators with variable coefficients, and he saw that with variable coefficients you still have very similar formulas which hold at least asymptotically. So for example, if you look at this equation for the green function, you see that here d comes to the power n minus 2, the leading order n minus 2, which is like here x minus 1 to the n minus 2. However, it is multiplied by some functions vk, which are solutions of transport equations, and you have more terms, this holds asymptotically. For the Higgs kernel, you have this, once again, this GK solve transport equations. And the transport equations are equations which operate along the geodesics. So all this is valid, at least for x near y. Now what does x near y mean? X near y here can be made precise, yeah? It is in Adamar's book, La Propagation des Ondes, it is there. So I don't know whether she probably did it earlier than that. Early 20s? Probably you can trace it earlier, but Adamar, this appeared in a book form in a very clear way, and everybody quotes this. But this goes at least to the early 20s. At least. And this is valid for x near y. X near y means that you take the exponential map at y, and you get nothing, or you start at x, start at y, doesn't matter, and your exponential map is well-defined, no singularities, no caustics, one-to-one, at least in a neighborhood. This is what you have in the Riemannian case. This is what it means here, x near y, yeah? I beg your pardon? Okay, these are two distinct things. The approximation here means that if you take a finite sum, the difference is going to be smoother than what you have here. It's going to vanish, yeah? Here the sum means actually that this is asymptotic as t goes to zero. Even so, you see, you have here a very, very sharp exponential decrease. But it still decreases even further to the power of t. This is asymptotic in the classical sense. This is a paper due to Molchanov and somebody else whom I won't mention here. Because everybody forgot I wrote about this, but apparently nobody read this paper. So let us not mention this. You see, when x is equal to y, this is standard pseudo differential theory. But for x is not equal to y, you have this high exponential. But still this is true. Once again, at least for x near y. Now, so this is all well for the case of regular elliptic cases. Now, the subject, what we want to do is to go to the area which is not covered neither by pseudo-differential operators and at least superficially cannot be covered here. The simplest example is the so-called Grushin operator, d squared dx squared plus x squared d squared dy squared. You see, this operator, for x not equal to zero, this is elliptic. For x equal to zero, it generates. So it is not a perturbation of a operator with constant coefficients. Nevertheless, this operator is hypoelliptic, and this was the best way to see this is to use the Hermander sum of square theorem. So the Hermander sum of square theorem says that if x1 up to xn are vector fields, and if the Lie algebra generated by them has rank n, where n is the dimension of the underlying space, at each point, then this operator is hypoelliptic. So for example here, the Lie algebra will be generated by d over dx, xd over dy. The rank is 2, no matter where you are, therefore this operator is hypoelliptic. In the same way, if you take your x to any power, it will still be hypoelliptic. And this is, since Professor Reiner is sitting here, I don't want to mention this any further. Now, this Grushin operator has one advantage and one disadvantage. The advantage is that since this is two-dimensional, it is easy to draw pictures and to see what happens. However, since there is this sharp heterogeneity, x not equal to zero and x equal to zero are so different from each other, this creates some difficulties. On the other hand, there is a so-called Heisenberg Laplacian, which has the disadvantage that it is higher dimension, but it has the advantage that it is uniform everywhere. So let me explain to you what the Heisenberg Laplacian is. So this is sorry. So the operator looks like this. You have, this is the x and y, here are n-dimensional vectors, x naught is a number. The group law is staring at you at the first line. The aj's are positive constants. In usual cases, people consider them to be equal to 1 or to 1/2. But there is an advantage of looking at aj difference, because a, you see things that you don't see otherwise, and b, that it is sometimes it is even, it is you understand better the case when they are equal if you think about the case where they are not equal. At any rate, you get 2n left invariant vector fields, which are written here xj and yj, and the Heisenberg Laplacian by definition is this operator here. This is the Heisenberg Laplacian. Now this Heisenberg Laplacian, it follows at once from the Hermander sum of sphere theorem that this is hyperelliptic as well, and believe me, this Heisenberg Laplacian is a close, very close relative of the Grouchin operator. You can reduce, you can quite easily reduce one to the other. And many things that you can say about one of them, you can say about the other. Now, for the Heisenberg Laplacian, way back, Folland computed the Green operator. And it turns out that the Green operator with kernel at the origin, once you have kernel at the origin, this can be a kernel everywhere. Yes, any question? So this kernel was computed by Folland in 1973 for the case that all the edges are equal to each other. So this led many people, and I do not exclude myself, on the wrong track, because we all thought, I shouldn't say all, but many people thought that this, therefore this, what you have here should be a distance, quote unquote. However, this is not so simple. First of all, it doesn't work if the edges are different from each other. Secondly, which is much more important, no asymptotic formula of this form, suppose we're looking at the heat kernel associated with the Heisenberg Laplacian, then you would expect, if this would be a distance, you would expect that such a formula should hold. And the answer is no. No such formula holds. No matter what you put for O or for M. So this means that something else happened. And, last but not least, this function, no matter what you put for O here, will not satisfy an Iconal equation. So which means that this is the wrong, that this is the wrong distance. This is not the correct distance. On the other hand, so how do I know so much about what does not work? Because at about the same time, maybe later, people did know what works. People did see that you have a function small f or capital F, which is written here. Look at this function small f. A, it is complex valued. B, it contains an additional parameter tau. And look at this V of tau, which should satisfy some sort of a transport equation. Now this function f satisfies sort of an Iconal equation for distance f. Not quite, because if we wouldn't have this term, this would be exactly an Iconal equation. But together with this term, it satisfies, this is an equation which is satisfied. You can look at tau, if you wish, as standing for the degeneracy of the operator, because there is one dimensional degeneracy. And then, lo and behold, with this, once we have this function f and this function v at our disposal, we can write kernels. We can write a kernel for the heat kernel here, can we write a kernel for the Green kernel here. And the question is, where did the distance go? Is there any distance? If there is a distance, where did the distance go? So let me make a very short fresh recollection of what happens in the Riemannian case. In the Riemannian case, we have this metric. We have length of a curve. Geodesics are local minimization of length. And that is why they satisfy n second order equations. N second order equations. And there is an exponential map. Now let us see what happens in the sub-Riemannian case, which is the one associated with metrics that you would get from the Riemannian, from the Heisenberg group. So for that, there is a more general concept of sub-Riemannian geometry, which will cover this one also, but let us restrict ourselves to the Heisenberg group case. So you have here, you have H is Hamiltonian associated with the Heisenberg-Laplacian. We would like to solve this Riemannian equation, only we cannot because of the singularity, because of the degeneracy. Therefore, we nevertheless, you know, I think that Kissinger said the illegal we do at once, and constitutional takes a bit longer. So, okay. So we define x1 up to xn, those invariant vector fields as to be orthonormal, and this d over dx0, which does not appear to have infinite length, then every linear combination of them has this length. So if you have a curve whose tangent at every point lies in this space, it has a length, which may be infinite if it doesn't lie there. And we can call, if you take the minimum, you take the Carnot, you get what is called Carnot-Cara-Theodori metric. If you look at the square, you get the energy of a curve. And now comes the theorem, which says that the extremal for the length, like in the Riemannian case, the extremal for the length, like the extremal for the energy, like in the Riemannian case, and that there are projections of my characteristic twist of H. Now, why do I call it a theorem? Because in more generality, it is wrong, and B, there is something to be proved even in this case, and some people made errors here, so nevertheless, this is a theorem. This is true. This can be proved, at least for this case. Now, if you look at the exponential map for these geodesics, we see that something interesting happens. You can see it even for the Grouchin case. Since this, the vector in this direction, if this is the xy or xx0 plane, every vector in this direction will have infinite length. So all geodesics which start issued at the origin must start parallel to the x-axis. Quite unlike the standard Riemannian exponential map. In a standard Riemannian exponential map, this will not happen because you have for every direction, you have a well-defined geodesic going in this direction. Here all geodesics must start here. However, they will turn around later. And where are they going to turn around? Here you have a picture. So there are really two for the Grouchin. This picture is valid both in the Grouchin case and the Heisenberg case. For example, suppose they want to join this point with this point. Then the minimizing geodesics will look like a parabola. But then I can be smart. I say, well, why not join the point which is one half distance from here to here, join this one, and then continue? Here you have the green geodesic, which will give you another geodesic, which is another length. And then you can do this with a third. So in short, you will get here countably many geodesics. This you have even for the Grouchin operator. Now, for the Heisenberg group, you can now rotate all this. So in general, if you are in the n-dimensional, case, so these are, you have two n plus one dimensions for the space, x n-dimensional, y n-dimensional, so we'll have a 2n minus n dimensional parameter family of geodesics times discrete countably many family of geodesics. So you have a lot and lots and lots of geodesics, but the distance would be the length of the minimizing geodesic. This would be the distance between two points. And the question is, does this distance play any role in our analysis? And at least part of the answer involves looking a bit deeper into this complex function f that we had before. So if one looks at this picture, Now, this picture is in the complex tau space. Remember that in our formulas, all the integrations were done over tau real. However, one can deform to the complex plane. And if one deforms to the complex plane, then one finds a curve, which I call gamma, which will be the path where the function gamma is, where the function f is real. Because the function real is always, the function f is always real on the imaginary axis. However, if df, d tau, is equal to zero, so you have a bifurcation, so you have another branch, another real branch branching off. In this example that I have shown here, you have five critical points on the imaginary axis. So it branches off here. Here at this point, I pi over 2, there was a singular, there is a pole because of the hyperbolic cotangent. Then you have another point. Then you got here, it bifurcates. So you went, and then at this point, this is the last one, and from here it branches to infinity. So you could say, well, who cares about this critical point? The answer is, this critical point encodes important geometrical facts. If you compute this function f at this critical, j's critical point, out comes the length of the j's geodesics. So in particular, if you take the one which is lowest, the one which is closest to the real line, you get the Carnot-Carotid distance. So now, out of this, we can learn several things. Since I promised to talk about propagation of singularities, I will show you one or two slides about the wave operator here. So for example, you can write the wave operator for the Heisenberg group. Now x, from here onwards, x will stand for x and y, or I really should have called it z. This is a two-dimensional vector. Then the wave at a point s is equal to this integral here along this curve gamma, where this is real. Now, why do I need that f will be real? Because otherwise I don't know what delta, I don't know what is the delta of a complex argument. But I do know what is delta of a real argument. This is why I have to push my integration more or less from the real axis, where the function f is complex, to this curve where the function is real. And then you get this function, and for this you get, you can change your coordinates, writing f as, you can make this change of coordinates. Why? Because this function f, it turns out that this function f is monotone on this complex curve that I've written to you. So you can look at f as if it is a distance, what I call here sigma, and then get a formula which is real. The complex nature has disappeared out of this formula here. But this is artificial. How to get this in a real method, I don't really know. Yes. The situation is it goes the other way around. You first have the formula for the heat kernel, and from this you deduce the formula for the wave kernel. Okay? Here you have the formula for the heat kernel. So here you have the one where the tau integration is over the real axis. Here you have the tau integration deformed to the gamma, to the curve gamma, and then now I made a change of coordinates. Okay? And so that you get the wave. And all this can lead, as Professor Nachman did in his thesis already, you can do propagation of singularities and compute the singularities of the kernel using these ideas. But now I want to look for to continue in a different direction. Because I want to So, to summarize this part, one would say that this complex formula somehow encode in a nice way all the lengths of all geodesics of all orders. How this is done is not yet clear. I think it is still worthy of investigation. But now I want to go to a more real, quote-unquote, problem. Still, the complex things are not far behind, but the question that I want to analyze is the question of asymptotics of the heat kernel. Where is this? Okay, here it is. So, here comes a formula which is rather known for a long time, and which is, here I suppose we have general N. If you think of N equal to 1, you already see the difference. If X is not equal to 0, then the heat kernel is asymptotic to this exponential, as it should be, and the power of T here is N plus half. N plus 1 is what you should have, because in the elliptic, you have two N plus 1 dimensional space, so you take half the dimension, it is N plus half. However, and here comes the thing which has no analog in the Riemannian case, at least not a simple analog. If X is equal to 0, so you are in this line above the origin, then this suddenly jumps and becomes 2n instead of n plus half. And the question that I want to address the rest of my talk is how this n plus half changes or is moved or is deformed to this 2n. Whether it is possible to get a uniform formula which will represent both of them. And let me first remark that you do then, how are these formula proved? So the case X not equal to 0 is proved by a saddle point method. You shift the tau integration to the line imaginary of I equal to tau critical, where tau critical is what we call tau 1, the first critical point of this function, in the upper half plane. Okay. While one could, in principle, get a uniform asymptotic representation by complex analysis, this approach is technically cumbersome, and B, not illuminating geometrically. If I have time at the end of my lecture, I will show a special case of this complex analysis method, and then it will open debate whether what I wrote here in AED is correct or not. But the method that I want to use now is different and is similar to what has been done in the Riemannian case, only it is more, it is technically more, because we are in the sub-Riemannian case and not in the Riemannian case, it is technically more involved. So, first of all, I want to explain to you this theorem, which as it appears here, looks a bit frightening, but the truth is an extremely simple thing. What I'm using is want to use a semi-group property, or if you are Russian, the Smoluchovsky-Einstein equation, which is just a semi-group property. And as we know, e to the at is equal to the e to the at over 2 times e to the at over 2. Right? So that if this is a heat kernel, this means that the heat kernel at xy is equal to the heat kernel at time t over 2 at xz integrated over z pzy. Now, in our case, or x prime. However, what is this? I see that there is a typo here. Now, the reason that I call this a theorem is because, A, this is not for the whole integrated over a whole space, but only on a certain subset E. And I claim that, and B, I didn't write exactly the heat kernel, but I write it asymptotics. And I restricted it to a set E, which is more or less a neighborhood of the midpoints, of the points where these two terms are equal to each other, and believe me that if you turn the wheels sufficiently many times, you see that this asymptotic formula is correct. In order to show to you in a clearer way how this set E looks like, I think this picture might explain. So we are interested in analyzing the behavior of the heat kernel in this set D, which is a set near where the change in the law occurs. So I take a point here, I look at the geodesic which joins with the origin, and here is the midpoint. And I take this set E, on which I integrated, is a sufficiently thick neighborhood of this midpoint. And then, of course, when this will become this, we will have a strip around the equator. And now we use the Laplace asymptotic method for asymptotic evaluation of integral, which, since we have here one of the world leading experts on Laplace asymptotic methods, so I really should be quiet. But at any rate, so let us set phi, the sum of these squares, is the energy of a broken geodesic which goes from the origin to the point which we are analyzing. And proposition one, which is well known in the Riemannian elliptic case, that this phi is critical at this point if and only if this is the midpoint of a geodesic. Now, why is this? This needs a proof. The proof for the Riemannian case would not work. And the reason being that since we are in the sub-Riemannian case, look at this remark here. We have to use differentials and not gradients, because the Carnot correlation is singular. You look at a function on a Riemannian surface, you don't really care where the gradient vanishes or whether the differential of the function is. This is the same thing. However, in this sub-Riemannian case, this is not the same thing, because you might have the gradient vanishing without the differential vanishing. And what we want is that the differential should vanish. Therefore, we have to use an extra argument, which I don't say is very difficult, but you have to be careful. You have to remember that the differential of this function is, that this function is just the Hamlet-Jacobi equation. Therefore, its differential is the xi, which goes along the solution of the Hamiltonian equation on the bi-characteristics. And if you want it to be zero, you want the xi that come from the last point and the xi which come from the beginning point just to match each other and cancel each other. Now, however, a more serious problem is that in Laplace asymptotic method, we would like also to find the Hessian of the. It is not enough to compute where the function is critical. We have to find its Hessian. And how are we going to compute the Hessian? Now, in standard differential geometry, geodesics are solutions of the Euler-Lagrange variational equations, as I said, two n-dimensional. N equations which are of second order. And therefore you get two N linearly independent Jacobi fields. And this is what was in the paper by Molchano, where he was computing the Hessian in the corresponding Riemannian case for conjugate points, he indeed computed this Hessian and he used many good things like connections and Christoffel symbols, Fermi coordinates, and so on and so forth. Everything breaks down in the sub-Riemannian case. In the sub-Riemannian case, the gammas are infinite. There is no analog of this equation. There is no Fermi coordinate. So what are we going to do? The answer is that you do what you should have done already in the Riemannian case, only you didn't do. Instead of looking at the geodesic in this way, you can look even in the Riemannian case on the Hamiltonian equation. Now, the Hamiltonian equations, you have two N equations of first order. So their equations of variation will once again give you two N linearly independent vectors. And as a matter of fact, I know of very few references where people did this in a Riemannian case. One which I know is Hector Sussman, some of the people here might know, who did this in a control theory context. At any rate, since the geodesics are the projection of the bi-characteristic strips, the difference between looking at this Euler Lagrange formalism. And this Hamiltonian formalism is that, whereas in the Riemannian case, this may be more natural, and this may be a bit artificial, even though they are equivalent, in the sub-Riemannian case, this one has no analog, whereas this one works can work. So we are therefore led to consider the variational equation for the Hamiltonian system, this Hamiltonian system. Okay? Yes, any objection? I beg your pardon? Well, I think that here you see it clearly, that the Lagrangian would lead you nowhere in the degenerate cases. Unless you do Lagrangian with side conditions, which is not very appetizing, and you're led to Hamiltonian anyhow. If you're looking at Lagrangian with side conditions, this is essentially the same as looking at Hamiltonians more. So we have to compute the Hessian of the critical points. So now let me introduce some notations, because still you have to be a bit careful. For example, the Hessian, usually you look at the Hessian as a bilinear map on the tangent space. Here, this is no good. You have to look at, since the exponential map is not well defined on the tangent space, but it is well defined on the cotangent space. So we have to look at the Hessian as a linear map of the tangent space into the cotangent space. Now, it is equivalent to saying the bilinear on the tangent, but for our purposes, it is much more natural. And then I use the following notation. If A and B are points in the Heisenberg group, beta is a geodesic of length parameterized 1, which goes from x, x0, c, c0 to this final point B. And A of this geodesic is just the partial Jacobian, which lets you from the C coordinates, the cotangent coordinates at the original point, to the X coordinates at the final point. So it goes from T star A to TB. This is the analog, this is the proper analog of the Jacobian of the exponential map, which you do in usual differential geometry. Okay? And then comes the following proposition. If X hat, X naught hat is a midpoint of a minimizing geodesic joining X, X naught with the origin, then let me start with 2 and 3. H X hat, X hat is regular if X is not equal to 0. H, the Hessian has rank 2 if X is equal to 0. And in all cases, it is written in this form. So what is this form? You have this Jacobian going from the origin to the midpoint. Here it goes from the origin to the, from the origin to the final point. Here it goes from the origin to the midpoint inverted. Here it goes from the midpoint to the final point inverted. So it is essentially a conjugate of this matrix. Now this, note that these two matrices, these two operators, are always regular, because going to the midpoint is always, even if you are near here, the midpoint is very far from here. So going from the midpoint to here, or going from here to the midpoint, is always in the regular sense. There is no problem, no singularities, no caustics, nothing. So these two are regular. So all the degeneracy lies in this one. And this one can be computed explicitly. And believe me, this case, when you do the computation, then you get two results here. Now Molchanov did the analog. Let me write to you show you what Molchanov did more precisely. Molchanov got this formula that you have here with the following picture. So he denoted by psi. Essentially, this is a Jacobian of the exponential map. You measure what is the ratio of the opening angle at the point Y to the opening angle at the tangent magnet at the point X. And then the determinant of the Hessian, you didn't compute the Hessian itself, the determinant of the Hessian is given by this psi, where Y is a midpoint, divided by these two psi. So you see, and this psi is under the determinant of the exponential map, you see that what our result is stronger in two respects. A, it is valid for the sub-Riemannian case as well, and B, it is for the operators, not so for the determinants. You see that these appear in the numerator like we had the inverses. Okay, how does one prove such a theorem? Once again I will spare you the computation, but remember once again that the xis are the differentials of the action. So you have something going from here in this direction, something going from this direction, and at this point we want them to we compute their differences. So when you compute your differences, then if the coordinates are PQ, Q is the coordinate of the space, P is the coordinate on the cotangent mantle, then you have this relation, and you have this relation. But since the Qs, the endpoints are fixed, so you have this relation, since the endpoints are fixed. Therefore, you get the conclusion this for the DE, you get this one. And if this is not convincing, maybe this will convince you more, but this is really the same idea, just written in more detail. So now that we have this, now we have a uniform asymptotic formula. And the uniform asymptotic formula looks as follows. This is a set of the midpoints, so if x is not equal to 0, it is just a singleton. If x is equal to 0, this is a 2n minus 1 dimensional sphere. Now, if you perform Laplace integration over the integral over E, remember E was this thick set which we had. If you now do standard Laplace asymptotics, you get that if x is not equal to 0, you get this, divided by this determinant which you have computed. And if x is equal to 0, then you get this, where h tilde is the determinant of the two variables where you don't have degeneracy. Remember, the codimension was 2. You have 2n minus 1 dimensional rotational symmetry and 2 dimensional non-zero. So you get this. But then, as I say, the appetite comes with the eating. So you would say, well, we still would like to have a more explicit way of seeing how the power here gets to the power here. And the answer is as follows. So I set delta to be, this is the normalized distance to this deadline. And it turned out that asymptotics are uniform with respect to the parameter if t is the time delta over t. And how do you do this? First of all, the proposition. There exists a positive function lambda such that the 2n minus 1 smallest eigenvalues of the Hessian are asymptotic to lambda times delta as we approach the x0 axis. So now we choose coordinates y1 up to y2n plus 1 for the near the midpoint such that h of phi, the Hessian, will be diagonal. The first 2n minus 1 coordinates correspond to the small eigenvalues. Then the integral over E. Then the function phi, the energy, can be written in the following way. Phi at the point near the midpoint is equal to phi at the midpoint plus sum of the 2n minus 1 dimensional squares times this lambda delta, where delta is now a small parameter, lambda is a eigenvalue asymptotically, and b1 and b2, which are different from zero, and some lower order terms. And therefore, the heat kernel will be equal to this phi, 2n plus 1, because we had n plus half for each one of the, we have n plus half from this one and n plus half for this one, and then we have this integral over E. But now you see what happens. You see that if delta is not equal to zero, you gain 1/2 power of t for each one of these. So you get, all in all, you get 2n plus 1 powers of 1/2 of t. So this p to the 2n plus 1 becomes 2n plus 1 over n plus 1 over half. However, if delta is equal to zero, then you get no contribution from here. The only contribution you get is from here, and therefore you get 2m plus 1 minus 2 halves, so you get a 2m. And you see clearly from this integration, this integral is reminiscent of the error integral, error function integral. It tends to a constant when you have zero variance. It tends to exponentially small thing when the variance is non-zero, and this you see exactly here. Okay? So, I don't see that my time is up, so I will not talk. There is a complex analog of this formula, and just will show you the result. It's a complex you get by deforming in a more precise way the integral, then you get this asymptotic formula, which is valid uniformly near x equal to zero. And you see it is not the same formula because it is a one dimension, obtained from a one dimensional complex integral rather than from two n plus one dimensional real integrals, but it is still uniform. And I leave it for discussion or for test which one of the formulas is more appealing. Okay? Thank you.